this quantization so we can get demand.
All right, well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak. So what I want to talk about today, it's a very big subject. So I just want to give a brief overview of what it is. So it's if you like, this talk is sort of a 50-minute survey of a big subject, which I find very interesting, and hopefully some of you will as well. So how many of you in the room know a little bit about quantum mechanics? Raise your hand. How many of you have heard of, say, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Okay, great. So I'm going to say a little bit about that and then motivate what mathematical quantization is. Okay, so motivation. So for me, the easiest way to motivate it is to talk about what separates classical physics from quantum physics. So let's say classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. So just in its most basic form, what is it that happens? So in classical physics, we have continuous energies. So like, so if you look at the sun, and you have the sun, you have planets that rotate around. Well, these planets have a certain energy, a certain velocity they're going at, and that velocity changes with respect to time. But if you look at their energy, that's staying constant. So the energy tells you. How far away they are from the sun at a certain speed. That's what it tells you. Or it tells you how big the orbit is. So basically, the larger the radius, well, then the more energy it has. And you can have any radius. Okay. Right. So in other words, if you were to give it more energy, if you were to hit it a bit, it would just get a slightly bigger orbit. But in quantum physics, this doesn't happen. So in quantum, well, you don't really notice it in real life. So real life is governed by quantum mechanics. You don't really notice that there's any problem with having any amount, any energy level whatsoever. But in quantum physics, say in an atom, electrons have only certain orbitals. Electrons have certain energy levels. So you'll have, the nucleus. Then you'll have electrons going around. And you'll have only a certain number at each. At each radius, you have only a certain number of electrons. And most radius, except for certain particular values of the radius, there is no electron at all. So electrons only have certain energy levels. That's what I wrote. So certain energy levels equals certain certain distances from the nucleus. Okay, this is something we all observe in real life. So that's one difference. So this is called a discrete energy levels. Discrete energy levels. Okay, so that's one thing. And now the next difference is, what about this Heisenberg uncertainty principle that I told you? So the other difference is that we can determine, there exists a precise position and velocity or momentum. Velocity, which is the same, which is equivalent to momentum. You just multiply. So the momentum is velocity times mass, right? Velocity times mass. So knowing one is equivalent to the other because the mass is not changing. So that's this you can have a precise value of it, and you can determine it for everything. But in the quantum case, that's not true. So if you know the position, you don't know the momentum, and vice versa. So there does not exist. Precise momentum and position. So this is sort of an interpretation of quantum mechanics that has been around and accepted for a long time. A sort of, I don't know what it was called, Copenhagen principle or something. But at one point, there were debates. You can see this is related to some debates that Einstein had with Bohr. Whether, well, maybe you can know what they are, but something prevents us from determining it. So maybe you can't know what they are because we can't determine it in real life, but maybe they actually exist. But the accepted interpretation of quantum mechanics is that there simply doesn't exist a state of pure momentum and position at the same time. Simply doesn't exist. So if you knew exactly what the momentum was, then you would have to have something which is spread out over all of space at some sort of wave that spread out over all of space. And if you knew exactly what the position is, then you would have something which is at a certain point, but there would be no information at all about the momentum. So it's simply not possible to know both at the same time. So it's like saying that particles are equal to waves. So the energy level, or the velocity of a wave, you can determine by the frequency of the wave. But if you have a pure frequency state, it's spread out over all of space. And on the other hand, if you have a particle at a certain location, it looks like a delta function, and there's no information at all. There's no frequency in there. So this is a basic difference between classical and quantum mechanics. So this is how so this is the basic principle that answers how to go from the classical to the quantum mechanics. So the basic principle is the principle of quantization, which explains how to solve. So if you view these features as problems of your Newtonian physics theory, and you want to solve them by introducing a new mathematical theory, this is how you do it. The principle of quantization is we replace commuting functions by non-commuting operators. So let me see how this, let me just explain briefly how this solves both of these problems here. So the first problem is solved. So instead of x of t as a position function of time, and p of t, say, as a momentum function, we have operators, x of t, and p of t, and then a pure position state, pure position, let's say, at, let's call it x, well, let me call it lambda. So let's say lambda is in our, let's say we're working on a line, so position at lambda is, let's say we're working on a line. So if we want to be at the point lambda in R, this would be a state such that x of t times v is lambda v. So v is a pure state. V is a pure state at position lambda. Or this could be a function of time, if you like. This could be a function of time. Okay? That would be a pure state of position lambda. But then, as you know, you could have something which is not an eigenvalue of x of t. It could be a combination, a linear combination of various different eigenvalues, and it would be located at different positions. Or it could be a discrete, it could be a continuous combination of them. So this is what you do, and then the same thing is true for position. I mean, for momentum, the p of t. So that's what you do, and how does that solve the problem of discrete states? Well, so now, in a situation where energies take discrete values, then these are the eigenvalues of the operator E, the energy operator. Right, so we say that E times V is lambda V can only occur when lambda is an eigenvalue of E. So in this situation of an atom, if you look at this quantum system and you look at the energy operator, you'll see it just has a discrete spectrum. And if you ever heard of something called the discrete spectrum of Laplacian, that's basically this is the same principle. The energy is basically Laplacian. So this is what you get. Okay, so that solves the problem of discrete states. It also solves the problem of having a pure position state or a state where you know different things about the position. Now, what about the uncertainty principle? There do not exist precise. So uncertainty principle, so to solve the uncertainty problem, well, you know that if let's say T and S are two operators on a vector space, or if you prefer, or two matrices, two square matrices, if you like, then there exists a common eigenbasis. So let's work over the complex numbers, so over C. So there exists a common eigenbasis of T and S only if, well, this is true also if we worked over R, but there exists a common eigenbasis only if T and S commute. TS equals ST. So what does it mean? So you had a common eigenbasis, which means a collection of vectors, a basis of vectors V that are eigenstates of both operators, then the operators have to commute. That's a simple exercise. It's just saying that TSV is the eigenvalue for V under T times the eigenvalue for V under S times V, which is STV. If V is an eigenstate of both, eigenvector of both ST. Well, in the complex situation, you can give a converse direction. You say if the two operators commute, and if they both admit eigenbases, then they admit a common eigenbasis. So if you know a little bit of linear algebra, you can say this is actually more or less an if and only if, at least with some caveats. So then, if you want to have a situation where you cannot exist pure momentum and position states, you simply need to have your operators, position momentum, not commute. So when P and X don't commute, there does not exist a pure momentum, at least not a full set of pure momentum and position states. And if they don't commute very strongly, then there doesn't exist any eigenvector of both of them. So in fact, we make them not commute as badly as you possibly can. You have this be a multiple of the identity matrix. So identity matrix is in some sense as far from the zero as you can, in the sense that it's an invertible operator. And it's a very simple invertible operator. It's very far from being zero. In some sense, it's as far from zero as you can get. And then where C is non-zero, of course. And then in this situation, in fact, there not exist any, it's a simple exercise, there not exist any eigenvector of both X and P. And you can prove, I think this was done in a previous talk for you guys, you can actually prove a precise version of uncertainty saying that the extent to which, so the standard deviation of position momentum, their product, is at least some constant which is related to this C. So that's a precise version. So the standard deviation of the position, that's the standard deviation of the momentum, is greater than or equal to something in terms of that C. Something C times something or other. Okay. So this was proved in a previous talk. Okay, so this solves both of the problems. So again, what quantization is doing is it's taking something commuting and replacing it by something non-commuting. So that's what quantization is. So now let me explain how this works in this particular case that we're doing here. So the standard example is is just, again, functions on the line. And so what we have is, so the Newtonian physics says that force is equal to mass times acceleration. And this is equal to the derivative of the momentum. Okay. Right, and so that's what the Newtonian physics says, and so now we can reformulate this. And how do we reformulate that? So let's take the energy operator. So the energy, or it's also called H sometimes, for the Hamiltonian, is written as the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And then this force, in a simple situation, the force is given by the derivative of the potential. The force is minus u prime. So this will be a function of x, say, this will be minus u prime of x. This is the simplest possible situation we can have, and the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared, which is 1 over 2m, where m is your mass, again, p squared. So put it in terms of position momentum. And so now there's a really nice way to encode these equations of motion, and that is, let's define a bracket on functions so that a bracket of f and g is equal to df dx dg, let's say dp dx minus the other way. Right, so in particular, bracket of p and x is 1, bracket of x and p is minus 1, bracket of x and x is 1, is 0, which is bracket of p of p. Now what we get is this amazing thing so what are the equations of motion? The equations of motion say that x prime of t is v, and that v prime of t is equal to this p over m, which is, v prime of t is the force, is minus u prime of x, which is this force, right? Because that MA is P prime, which is a force. So these are the equations of motion, and we can rewrite that as E with P is P prime of T, and E with X is X prime of T. Okay? Why does that work? Let me just explain how that works. So E was, again, equal to 1 half mv squared plus u of x. So we take E with P, it's just this u of x part that, so this is, this. So E of P is the same as u with P. And then that's just going to take the derivative of u, so we get P prime. So we get minus u prime on this side. And then if we take E with X, that will just, this is going to be equal to 1/2 1/2 2mp squared with X. And that is going to be, and that's again going to be equal to P over M, which is what we, which is the velocity, right? So we need that the v of t, x of prime of t is a velocity, which is p over m, and p prime of t is a force, which is u prime of x. So in other words, we can rewrite the equations of motion in this form here. So the Hamiltonian form, physics, says that f prime of t is equal to the bracket of e with f for all functions, all observable functions. So you can rewrite Newtonian physics in this way. Now this explains how you do quantum physics. So in quantum physics, you replace every functions by operators. And now, so then this E is replaced by a Hamiltonian operator. What's called the Hamiltonian operator, H, and the equations of motion just become, well, now we have to have some Planck constant in here, but it becomes, depending on how you you set it up, it becomes f prime of t is equal to this bracket of h with f. And now you have to have the Planck constant in here, so you can put it here. So this looks very similar to that formulation where E, as I said, is sometimes called H, the Hamiltonian. But now we've replaced this this additional structure on functions, this bracket, by something which is intrinsic to the operator. So somehow this explains where this bracket came from. It's a commutator of operators. And it also explains why it is, again, that we can have an uncertainty principle because the operators may not commute with each other. Okay, so this is the equation of motion. So let me just, before I get too far afield mathematically, let me just to say how this recovers the standard equation you might have seen. So in this particular example, so in the example I have here, What are the operators you do? So again, I had said that I wanted this to be a multiple of identity. So this is how you solve the problem. So the solution for functions on a line is that we let our operators be differential operators on functions on a line, So we just take differential operators in one variable. And now x gets replaced by the operator x, which is just, if you apply it to a function, you get x times the function. That's the position coordinate. And p gets replaced by the operator p, which is just taking, depending on how you do it, again, I h bar d dx. All that. Right? So now if you take the commutator of I h bar d dx with x, then if you apply this guy to any function f, it's an easy thing to check that you just get I h bar times f. So I e p with x is I h bar times identity. So that's this thing I promised here. And it also shows you that this is closely related to this bracket here. So this bracket here was p with x is 1, and this bracket here is sort of multiplying by ih. Okay? Okay, so this is what you get, and now h is 1 half p squared, 1 over 2 mp squared, plus v of x, which you can also rewrite as minus h squared over 2m dx squared plus v of x. Right? And so now the Schrodinger equation is exactly this equation of motion I wrote. Is saying that h with f is f prime of t, where again h is this operator here. So probably, how many of you have seen this equation before? This operator here, raise your hand. The Schrodinger equation. So this is how it comes out of this procedure. Okay. Okay. So now let me give you the mathematical formulation. So here's a definition. So what we're going to say is that this is a quantization of functions. So a quantization is a non-commutative algebra. So what is an algebra? It's a ring, or it's something where you can add and multiply functions. A non-commutative algebra, which in terms of H, which deforms a commutative algebra. H equal to 0. So to be more precisely, if A0 is a commutative algebra, e.g., so in the case we had here, we had functions and two variables. Position and momentum. So, right, that was the case we had here. And then AH bar is a non-commutative algebra. As an algebra, so this is an algebra which as a vector space, it's just A0 brackets H is defined as the power series of the form A times H to the M. So you can form power series in this H. Thus, it's viewed as a formal parameter. This is called a deformation quantization, because you now, instead of H being a very small number, we can let it be a parameter. So this is an AH, and then AH recovers a zero as h goes to zero. So ah bar modded out by h bar times ah is isomorphic to a zero. Or if we want to say that in a less abstract form, i.e., if we take this product, so let's call the product on AH, let star be the product on AH, and dot be the product on A0, the usual product, then we require that A star V is equal to A times B plus H times higher order stuff. So plus what I'm going to call this O of H. And O of H just means, this notation means, it's A, B, A times B plus something, some remainder term, epsilon, where epsilon is in H bar AH. So it's a sum of power series that start with H, with M equal to 1. Okay? And this could have been these could be different, of course, A sub M. Right. So this is what a quantization is now. That's how you can define it. And now, in this situation, we recover a certain structure on A0 from A star B minus B star A over H. In this way. So how does this work in the example we had? In the example, so in our example, we had that P bracket X was equal to was just equal to IH times identity. And so if we divide by H, we can divide by I also, that sort of doesn't really a matter, but then if we divide by H, we just get I. And so then we could define the bracket. Well, let me just go ahead and put the I here so we can call it 1. So we could have had or H could be replaced by IH if you prefer in the quantum case. So if we do this, we have 1, and so now we can define, we get this, recover this bracket, PX is 1, and then in fact, we get if, so in fact, if we take a polynomial in P and X, if we take polynomials, and P and X, we recover again the same Poisson structure that I defined before. We cover this guy we had before, which was df dx dg dp, other way around, minus df dx dg dp. So what I'm saying is that you can give a definition of a quantization which incorporates what we had before. And so this is what a quantization is. And you can also prove proposition that this structure is what's called a Poisson bracket. So it's a Lie bracket, which means that if you take a bracket of any two functions, it's skew symmetric. And it satisfies a certain identity called Jacobi identity, which looks like this. It's called Jacobi. Okay. So the Lie bracket means that these two conditions are satisfied. That's called a Lie algebra structure. Have you heard of a Lie algebra before? So Lie algebra means you have a bracket satisfying these two conditions. Now, Poisson structure is more than that. a Poisson structure means that you're a commutative algebra with the additional property that you have this Leibniz condition. Leibniz condition, which says that FG with H is FG with H plus G F with H. Okay? All right, so quantum physics has sort of motivated this general definition, and now that I've given you that, I can explain what this does to lots of stuff. So how do we generalize the example we just gave on a line? We could do it on an arbitrary dimensional space. So examples of quantization. So we can generalize the example I was just studying, the motivation to arbitrary and dimensions. So we can take functions, C infinity functions on R2n, or you could look at polynomial functions if you like. Or polynomial functions, either over R or over C, in 2n variables. And then we can replace this by certain differential operators. So we'll take differential operators of the form. But if we want to put these H bars in there, then we'll take differential operators of order less than or equal to n times h bar. This is the differential operators of order less than or equal to n. Now let me put a different sum, less than or equal to m, and we'll sum over all m. So take differential operators of order less than or equal to m and multiply it by h bar to the m, and that way we have the property that when you take the commutator of two differential operators, you always have an h bar in there. So this is just a way of saying that, say, if you have d dx, you have to have at least an h bar in there, and that way the commutator with x is h bar, and when we set h bar to 0, everything commutes. So this is a way of ensuring that when h bar is set to 0, when we set h bar to 0, we get these usual functions back. Or you could do it with the polynomials. So the only difference between these two examples here is you use differential operators with polynomial coefficients or smooth coefficients. Those are the only two differences. Only difference. Okay. So that's one example of quantization. Okay, but another example is you might want to know, well, the way I define this, I just took the original algebra and I took power series in H. So it's not really obvious here when you have differential operators why this is the same thing as just taking functions with power series in H. They don't look exactly the same. So I kind of swept that under the rug a bit. But the reason is that, So let me give you another example. So the reason is that we really want to use the definition I gave here, it really makes more sense if we use polynomial functions. So let's take, if we take polynomial functions, this is a bit simpler, x1 to xn, p1 to pn, then we can consider a0 sitting inside of ah. Sitting inside of differential operators. So let's call this algebra dh. to consider A0 sitting inside of DH, where we map some monomial, let's call it A1 AK, to the symmetrization, 1 over K factorial, of all permutations of that, A sigma of 1, A sigma of K. So all permutations of the way of writing it. So e.g., let's, if we take, for example, x1 p2, this will map to x capital x1 p2 plus capital p2 x1. So there's an obvious, there's a natural way to embed your polynomial functions inside of differential operators by just writing all possible ways of ordering them and then dividing by the number of ways you've done that, so symmetrizing it. So if we do that, and there's an exercise, then an exercise shows that there's a very nice formula for the star product that you get. That the F star G, or now these are polynomial functions, is equal to a sum. So it's equal to something that you can call e to the 1 half dp dx minus dx. I'm going to tell you what this means. And then we're going to have to multiply this by ih, or just h, depending on whether you have an ih or an h, times fg, and then multiply. So it becomes a mu. So mu is going to be the operation that takes F tensor G to FG. And then we're going to have some particular operator here. So let me give you what that formula is. So this operator here, so E here, E to the T is 1 plus T plus 1 half T squared plus 1 cubed T cubed. This is the power series factorial for exponential. So what we get is that F star G, so if we want to write out the terms, F star G, so the first term is we just take F mu of F tensor G with no H bar in there at all, and that's this formula here. So we get FG, as I required for quantization. The next term is we just take this operator here, this is T, so we take T of F tensor G and multiply. But what's that? That's this is equal to, well, we just apply that operator, IH bar, we take dP of F, dF dP times dG dx, right? Because we're applying it to those two components. So this guy gets applied to that, and this guy gets applied to that, minus the other order. Okay. And I had a 1 half in here too. Right? Okay. So that was T applied to that, and then you multiply the two with this mu. And then the next term will be 1 half mu T squared of F tensor G. So what's T squared? Well, you do the same thing, but now we have to square this guy. So I can write out this term, and then maybe it'll be clear how this formula works. So if we square this, we get 1 quarter d squared f dp squared d squared g dx squared. If we square this term, if we square that one, we get the same thing, except switching the x and the p. So d squared f dx squared d squared g dp squared. And then the cross terms, we're going to have minus, so we could have df d squared f dp dx, d squared g dp dx. If we take this one and that one, or we could do the other order. So we'll get two of these. Okay? And so then that will be what the formula is, and then we have higher order terms. So it's an exercise to see that if you map these functions to these to the operators here by taking capital X and P in every possible order, then you multiply differential operators and you rewrite it in terms of the same symmetrized functions, then you get this formula. And so the example would be if you take so let me just show you how that works in the simplest possible case. So e.g., p star x is equal to p times x is equal to p times x, right? And this is equal to 1/2 p times x plus x times p plus 1/2 p times x minus x times p, right? And this guy, if I called this map this embedding iota, this guy here, the first guy here, is 1/2 iota of px. So it's what we call px. So it's 1/2 of px. And then the second term is this commutator, which we agreed was 1/2 p with x, which we agreed is 1/2 px plus 1/2 ih bar. And that's 1/2 px plus 1/2 the bracket of p with x. And so you see that that in particular this formula for the star product agrees with this formula I wrote here, as I promise, and it's also a way to see why when you take p star x minus x star p you just get this bracket. So with this with the ih correction to it times ih. Okay? So that's the standard example of quantization. And now so these are the two first standard examples of quantization. And then in my remaining time, let me just tell you a little bit about where one can go from here. So first of all, so what can one do from here? There was nothing requiring us to use Rn. So we could, in fact, could let our non-commutative algebra be differential operators on any nice space, smooth space X, so that Rn gets replaced by X. Right? And then what would our limit as h goes to 0 be? So limit as h goes to 0 is what's called functions on what's called a cotangent bundle to X. So this is twice the dimension of X. Dim of t star x is twice the dimension of x, and this is equal to the collection of pairs of a point x and a momentum vector at x. X and p, or x is in x, and p is a momentum vector at x. So that's the dimension of x in size vector at x. So this is another example, and then the quantization is exactly the same. It works exactly the same way as I just described it. And so in my remaining time, I wanted to say a completely different example. So if you know about Lie algebras, it's another example. If G is a finite dimensional Lie algebra, then we already have a Poisson bracket. We have a Lie bracket on G, and this extends uniquely to a Poisson bracket on the polynomial on these polynomials in G, which we call sim G equals polynomials in G, and say x1 to xn, which is a basis of G. Or this is also equivalent to functions on G star. And then a quantization is the enveloping algebra with an, the way I define it, with an H bar in it, UH of G. And this is the algebra generated by G with the relations xy minus yx minus h bar times the bracket for x and y and g. So so then you can get the representation theory of G viewed as a quantization of your phase space G star. And you can also express this as invariant. So if you know Lie algebras are the same as invariant vector fields in the Lie group associated to it, then you can also write all of this as left invariant functions and differential operators on the group. So that's another way to do it. So you can see that the representation theory of G comes heavily into play here. And has the pizza arrived yet, or should I say a few more words? They'll want knocking the door. Okay. So let me say a couple more words. Are there any questions up to this point? I could also take a question before the chaos begins. Anybody have a question? Anything that didn't make sense? So I can say another word about this. And okay. So what I want to say is there's lots of interesting representations, a lot of interesting mathematics that comes out of this, but there's something called integrable systems that arise into here. Integrable systems. This is basically a mathematical version. Well, it's a mathematical version of conserved quantities. So if you have some number of functions, f1 to fk, which commute, which have zero, which Poisson commute, which means that these brackets are zero, then we can ask to lift them to commuting operators. F1 to Fn on the quantization. So in particular, usually the first one of this list, F1, is the Hamiltonian operator, the energy function. And so then the fact that Fi with F1 is zero is saying that Fi prime of t is a zero for all I. So these are conserved quantities. So the Fi's are the conserved quantities. They don't change. So the first one, the energy doesn't change. This is conservation of energy. This is one of the first laws of physics. But when you have operators that commute with it, then you know that those are also conserved quantities. And then you can use this basically to reduce your system's number of variables, reduce the number of degrees of freedom by saying, well, let's just restrict ourselves to states that are constant in each of these. And so the problem of integrable systems is to lift such conserved quantities to operators, and then you know that your quantum state can also have its number of freedoms reduced by looking at eigenvalues, eigenvectors under these operators. So this is a big problem in physics, and it turns out that in many cases you're able to do this, and it's a powerful tool for in the completely integrable state. Would mean that k is equal to the dimension of your x, which is one half the dimension of phase space. So this is the e.g. in the case where your phase space is functions on this coordinate bundle has a dimension of phase space is twice the dimension of x. And then your quantization could then be differential operators on this x. Or in the case where x was Rn, then you're completely integrable. So when x is Rn, this would mean that that k is equal to n. So in the completely integrable situation, then knowing the values of all of these guys completely determines. This is the maximal amount of information you can know of conserved quantities. Knowing these is the maximum number of conserved quantities. You cannot possibly have more than that. It's a version of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's saying, for example, you cannot know position and momentum. You can only know one. Or if you know the energy, there's no other function whose value is conserved when you're just in one variable. But when you're in n variables, you can have n conserved quantities. And so then what you get is, in very nice situations, your variety, your space x, then in very nice situations, your phase space, in this case T star X, is foliated by level sets of these F1 to Fn. And then in your quantization, you can basically solve your system using these operators. So this is something that comes up in physics, and it's closely related to the Lax equation. So what I was going to say then is that, and then closely related to this is you can take symmetries. Let me just say one final word, symmetries of spaces. So like, for the atom, everything that we know about the atom comes down to looking at the angular momentum. Is preserved, and this comes down to spherical symmetries. So we can reduce our space of states using the symmetry by rotation. And that more or less comes down to using these these angular momentum operators, which will commute with your Hamiltonian. And then when you reduce these, then that simplifies your system dramatically. And there's a lot of really interesting examples of how you can solve differential equations that way, and how you can elucidate representation theory of rotational groups in that way. But now that pizza has arrived, so I think I'll stop. Are there any questions?